A service of remembrance is underway to pay tribute to the victims.
Energy is recognized as the key to all activity on Earth. Natural science is the study of the sources and control of natural energy. And social science, theoretically expressed as economics, is the study of the sources and control of social energy, or society, as a whole. Both, of course, are bookkeeping systems, mathematics. Therefore, mathematics is the primary energy science, and the bookkeeper can be king if the public can be kept ignorant of the methodology of the bookkeeping. You see, folks, all science is merely a means to an end. The means is knowledge. The end is control.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Terror attacks by Islamists in Nice. But actually, is it a terror attack at all? Is Islamists involved? This guy wasn't one. Never believe what you hear, especially if a president is telling you it, and the actual evidence isn't even there. Tonight we'll be discussing last night's attack in Nice with a truck that was driven into a crowd of people that's been called a terrorist attack. Of course, the guy just happens to be a Muslim. And if you're not a Muslim, apparently you can't be a terrorist. As we found out with the murderer of Joe Cox, the MP, just before the Brexit vote. Also tonight, we take a look at Stratfor. The chief executive guy's name is George Friedman. What are the US's real goals? In a rare, candid interview, he talks straight like we do. Also, Anthony Sutton wrote a series of books on the funding of Hitler and the funding of Stalin. And he looks at the role of Henry Kissinger in supplying crucial nuclear weapons technology to the Soviet Union in the 1970s. But we start this week, Martin, with the attack last night in Nice. So my thoughts immediately are that the French police have said this guy had no connections to any kind of terrorist group or jihadi group at all, and his only previous convictions were petty crime.
Well, that may be so. As regular listeners to this show will be aware, that whenever these incidents occur, the question uppermost in our minds is this an orchestrated event? Because we know in the past that the intelligence services have orchestrated such events in order to create certain kinds of effects.
None of these jihadi groups, Al-Qaeda, ISIS or anybody, has claimed responsibility.
No, and it may be that this is a lone nut attack. We can't rule that out, and logically can't rule it out. But don't forget that this is actually part of a pattern where they have claimed that it's ISIS involved. The people involved, say in Canada, the attack on the Canadian Parliament, or in Australia, they turn out to be disturbed individuals with drug and alcohol and mental health issues who happen to have some kind of Islamic background. And in the US, many of these people have been deliberately entrapped by the FBI. They've been persuaded that they are a member of Al-Qaeda or ISIS, to understand that they're going to be provided with weaponry, explosives, etc., and then arrested and told, oh yes, we always knew you were a terrorist. Virtually everybody that the FBI has captured, put on trial and put behind bars in the US has been entrapped in this way, and they're a sorry parade of losers. Unlike the sort of people who blew up the Marine barracks in Beirut in 1983, who were dedicated terrorists, if that's what you want to call them. But of course,
let's just say something more about the Nice attack. Is that surely if you're trying to do some sort of damage to the French state, you would attack a hard target of some kind, which
indeed
represented the French state, not just ordinary innocent people. I mean, that just doesn't mean the targeting as well seems very.
It does. If you've got suicide bombers, I mean, the military use of suicide bombers was demonstrated in 1983 by Hezbollah in Lebanon, where they killed 250 US Marines. Who were all armed, etc., and that were all soldiers in uniform, and they all died because these guys were brave enough to take them on. If you've got suicide people, then that's what you'd do. But of course, the real problem here is that as Vincenzo Vincinguero, the fascist terrorist who was part of the Gladio network in Italy, said in the famous film that was on BBC Two made by Frankovic, he said the purpose of these attacks is to attack the innocent, is to attack the general public, so that they are frightened out of their wits and will then accept greater powers for the secret state.
Well, that's
the same secret state which is possibly behind the attack.
Well, one of the things he says is people turn to the state for protection.
Indeed.
It's almost like a mafia.
It's a protection racket. Yes, and of course the mafia, the CIA and the far right in Italy were the nexus within which Gladio was formed. As Richard Cotterill, the former MEP, Conservative MEP for the South West, wrote in his book, fascist CIA fascist mafia dagger aimed at the heart of Europe. Now, we don't know enough detail about what happened on Friday to jump to conclusions, but given what's happened
Thursday evening, yeah.
Yeah, all right, but what's happened at the Charlie Hebdo attacks, the attacks in Brussels, there's strong evidence emerging there that there was foreknowledge, that these people were well known to the security services, were in fact allowed to carry out the attacks, may not in fact have carried out the attacks. The general pattern is that somebody gets the blame and ends up dead or in prison and silenced, like Sarnaev after the Boston bomb attacks, but the actual attacks are carried out by operatives who are professionals, like the Bataclan attack, and that they escape and carry on doing what they're doing.
The background to all of this, of course, is that there's enormous unrest in France at the moment with the new Labour laws. François Hollande is the most unpopular French president ever.
Yeah, but I would suggest to you it's more likely that if it is a false flag attack, it's coming from within the French secret services for sure, but they will also be operating as the Safari Club did in the 1980s, which was set up by the DGSE in order to try and force France into states of emergency and so on, because there's a temptation. You see, after Brexit now, with Britain outside the EU, it's quite possible that the French and the Germans might decide to end sanctions on Russia. That would not suit the policy of the American oligarchy, and that's why you're probably getting these kind of attacks in France. Possibly. There are various possible motives, but any independent police investigation of these incidents should look into all of these possibilities and all of these motives.
Okay, the other background to all of this is that the French have been rather reluctant, haven't they, to go along with NATO attacks in the Middle East?
Well, they have and they haven't. Don't forget that, you know...
Roland Dumas, for example, blowing the whistle on Syria. Iraq, they couldn't get the they couldn't get the Iraq war vote through because of the French.
No, they couldn't. But sadly, you will find that the Socialist Party in France, the right wing of the Socialist Party, which is dominant in the government, is in fact more pro-Israeli, more pro-neocon than the right in France, either of the mainstream right of the Sarkozy and Dumas, or the more extreme right of the National Front. You've got a situation now where in Turkey, in France, in Britain as well, we are having terrorist attacks which are part of an orchestrated program, a strategy of tension, as they used to call it in Italy, to achieve certain political results.
The other thing to mention is, of course, that Syria may have upside in all of this, because it's a traditional area of French influence in Syria. And
indeed, which is why the French have been particularly belligerent about Syria.
A lot of the French intellectuals, for example, are pointing the finger at Hollande and saying, you should be on Assad's side. He's the guy who's really trying to fight Syria.
Well, yes, some are and some aren't. I mean, you've got Bernard Henry Levy, who's a rampant neocon, neoliberal. It's a messy picture.
This is just one. That's Bruno Guiguet, And he's pointing out that you tell us, he is addressing François Hollande, you are fighting terrorism, but you never cease your demonisation of and campaign against Syria and of Bashar al-Assad.
Indeed, and the French socialist regime led the way in the overthrow of Gaddafi. And then, of course, the Western intelligence services, including our own, were then complicit in supplying Gaddafi's former arsenal to the rebels in Syria, along with training provided by people like the British SAS. So in actual fact, our fingerprints are all over this. Now, at the very least you can say, as the Russians and the Syrians will no doubt point out, you're having these attacks in your country, in Brussels, for example, directly related to your support for these kind of people in Syria. But I think in actual fact we can go further than that. I would suggest that the terrorists in Syria are being armed and directed by NATO intelligence services, and quite possibly the terrorists inside Brussels, inside Belgium, France, etc., are also being directed by them. And we've got a track record of NATO doing this going back to the 70s and the 80s. Why do people presume that they've stopped doing it now? I don't presume any such thing.
Let me just read the end of this letter. This is Bruno Guiguet's letter to François Hollande. There's a link to it. I'll put it up on our website at www.thisweek.org.uk when I get back home later on. You've been advised, he's addressing Hollande here, by pseudo-experts whose intellectual independence is entirely dependent on how much you pay them. So it's impossible for you to extricate yourself from your errors without being overruled. Instead, you continue to throw dust in our eyes with this state of emergency, which of course is there from the Paris attacks last year, and to windmill your little arms. We are 9 months away from the elections, where, of course, you will try to manipulate the facts. Your legacy will be the rotting fruit of your political ineptitude, the manifestation of your incompetence as a minister who confuses Saddam Hussein with Bashar al-Assad, an absurdity that does not even raise a smile on this day of grief.
Well, I mean, that sounds quite a sensible critique. The fact of the matter is that as I've said before, the track record of the Western intelligence services is abysmal. The Safari Club, which I mentioned earlier, was set up by the DGSC in the 1980s to pull together all of the Western intelligence services and Saudis and the Israelis to support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, by providing lots of foreign mercenaries to fight for them, trained by the French Foreign Legion and the British Special Forces.
The death toll now is around about 84, with 150 injured.
Appalling.
Actually, one does wonder whether, you know, there is any kind of real critique of, and any actual, I mean, I said this right at the very start, but we've got this situation where when a Muslim does something like this, drives a truck into a crowd of people, it's considered a terrorist attack. But when a white guy, a former member of the BNP, or maybe he's even still a member of the British National Party, kills an MP, it's not a terrorist attack. What's going on here?
Well, I don't know if he was a BNP, he was a Britain Firster,
I believe. He was, at one point, member of the
BNP.
Well,
I mean, more to the point is Anders Behring Breivik in in Norway. He's supposedly just a loony independent operator. Now, can't people see that there's an awful lot of loony independent operators out there, isn't there? And what they've all got in common is a troubled history with mental health, alcohol, drugs, and so on. Now, these people are prime targets for being patsied into being blamed for these attacks. Now, this particular attack, I mean, I one of the anomalies that's just come to mind when I've looked at briefly at the reports is that the truck apparently had rifles and grenades in the truck. Now, what on earth would a loner do driving a truck like that into a crowd of people? Why would he need rifles and grenades in the back of the truck? And I only ask.
I made the point.
And were there any rifles and grenades in the back of the truck? I'm not sure I believe the story we're being told.
I mean, we made this point with Jeff. I mean, there is no way that controlling the internet or spying on every single journalist, lawyer, and MP, a politician in the world is going to stop an attack like this.
No, it's not. And I think what we really need is that the police need investigative powers, but they need those investigative powers independent of the intelligence services. I mentioned the Safari Club, I mentioned it for the third time. The Safari Club was set up by the DGSE of all the Western intelligence services working with the Saudis and the Israelis to create an Islamist terrorist international brigade to fight in Afghanistan in the 1980s. That is the source of Al-Qaeda. Those are the people who created Al-Qaeda. What we're expected to believe is that the DGSE, MI6 and CIA created Al-Qaeda and then they lost control of it. Now, that stretches credulity, certainly stretches the credulity of the Russian general staff and the Syrian general staff.
Also, the we mentioned the role in Syria there, and you talked last week, didn't you, when we were discussing the Chilcot report. You were talking about Wesley Clark and his 7 countries in 5 years.
Yeah.
Syria was one of those, wasn't it?
It was.
And so the French are now on board, with the NATO and US attempt to take over the Middle East and balkanize the Middle East. We mentioned also last week the Yinon plan. Is Syria part of that?
Of course. I mean, the Yinon plan, just to recap for the audience, was a plan developed by the Israelis in the 1980s to balkanize and effectively create civil wars in the countries surrounding them, so that these countries were no threat to Israel's ambitions. And the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, I mentioned them earlier, the weaponry they used was Soviet weaponry, which had been captured by the Israelis from the Syrians and the Egyptians, and then supplied to the Mujahideen so that it would be deniable. So the Mujahideen would look as if their weaponry was captured from the Russians. It wasn't captured from the Russians. It was Israeli weaponry supplied to them by the British and the Americans.
This is Charlie Wilson's War.
Charlie Wilson's War, yeah.
Great film, actually. Funnily, they haven't repeated that.
Well, it's a funny film because it's a film made in an era when the right wing in America used to boast about their evil powers to get Islamists to do what they wanted, and Charlie Wilson, the coke snorting, whiskey drinking Christian fundamentalist, armed the Mujahideen, according to the film. It was paid by Tom Hanks, and they go to visit the Israelis in the film, and they get the weaponry from them, and you know, it used to be common knowledge that the Western Intelligence Services created Al Qaeda, but we've suddenly forgotten about all of that.
Martin, not Christian fundamentalist, can we call him a Christian Zionist?
Well, he wasn't. I don't think he was much of a Christian of any sort. He was just a chancer, frankly.
Okay. Anyway, as I said at the top of the hour, we're going to have a listen now to a guy called George Friedman. He's the. Maybe before we do that, Martin, you could just explain who Stratfor are that George Friedman is the chief executive of and founded.
Well, they're an supposedly independent geopolitical and analytic organisation. You have to pay if you want to get their more, recondite briefings. They do some stuff for free. They're regarded as a kind of very close to the CIA. That's all I'll say. A lot of their people are ex-CIA. Very close to the US intelligence community.
Well, they do on their website analysis, and they do something called Crisis Watch. At the moment, I've just brought their website up. Israel forces cut off Islamic State in Hawja, and Venezuelan military makes political intervention in the beginning, also the end of the UAE involvement. So they're kind of looking at these big, in a way, are they getting their information from the intelligence services?
Yeah, but that's why it has to be taken with a pinch of salt, because the stuff that they push out is what the intelligence services want out there. That doesn't mean that it's necessarily true. It's sophisticated analysis of a high level.
You know
level.
What, it reminds me of
but
a
it's
bit,
not necessarily
it
true.
It reminds me a bit of the Economist paper, yeah. The magazine.
Yeah.
It's like this is the kind of official view, isn't it? Is that what it is?
And yeah, also, I mean, they obviously have very high level contacts, but then of course that means that they're manipulable. The high level contacts say to them, you know, such and so and so is going on. Stratfor then report that, and that is what those high level contacts want those in the know to think is really going on, but I don't necessarily believe everything they say.
Anyway, this clip from George Friedman was this time last year, actually I think maybe even May, June 2015, where he talks about what the US goals have really been for the last 100 years or so.
The primordial interest of the United States, over which for a century we have fought wars, the First, Second Cold War, has been the relationship between Germany and Russia, because united they are the only force that could threaten us, and to make sure that that doesn't happen. If you're a Ukrainian, is essentially reach out to the only country that will help you, which is the United States. Last week, 10 days ago, General Hodges, commander of U.S. Army Europe, visited Ukraine. He announced that U.S. trainers would now officially be coming, not just unofficially coming. He actually pinned medals on Ukrainian fighters, which by protocol of the military is not the way. Foreigners don't get to pin on, medals. But he did, showing that this was his army. He then left And in the Baltics announced that the United States would be prepositioning armor, artillery, and other equipment in the Baltics, Poland, Romania, and Bulgaria, which is a very interesting point. So the United States, and now to yesterday, the United States announced that it would be sending weapons. Tonight, of course, they denied it, but they are. The weapons will go. In all of this, the United States has acted outside the context of NATO. Because NATO has to have a 100% vote. Any one country can veto anything. And the Turks will veto it just for giggles. The point is that the United States is prepared to create a cordon sanitaire around Russia. Russia knows it. Russia believes that the United States intends to break the Russian Federation. I think that, as Peter Lorre put it, we don't want to kill you, we just want to hurt you a little bit. Either way, we are back at the old game. And if you go ask a Pole or a Hungarian or a Romanian, they live in a totally different universe from a German. And they live in a totally different universe from a Spaniard. So there is no commonality in Europe. But if I were a Ukrainian, I would do exactly what they're doing. Try to draw the Americans in. The United States has a fundamental interest. It controls all the oceans of the world. No power has ever done that. Because of that, we get to invade people and they don't get to invade us. It's a very nice thing. Maintaining control of the sea and control of space is the foundation of our power. The best way to defeat an enemy fleet is to not let it be built. The way the British managed to make certain that no European power could build a fleet was to make sure the Europeans were at each other's throats. The policy that I would recommend is the one that Ronald Reagan adopted toward Iran and Iraq. He funded both sides so they would fight each other and not fight us. This was cynical. It was certainly not moral. It worked. And this is the point. The United States cannot occupy Eurasia. The moment the first boot sets the ground, the demographic differential is we are totally outnumbered. We can defeat an army. We cannot occupy Iraq. The idea that 130,000 men would occupy a country of 25 million. Well, the ratio in New York of cops to citizens was greater than we had deployed in Iraq. So we don't have the ability to go across, but we do have the ability to first support various contending powers so they concentrate in themselves with political support, some economic support, military support, advisors. And in extremis, do what we did in Japan, in Vietnam, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan. Spoiling attacks. The spoiling attack is not intended to defeat the enemy. It's intended to throw him off balance.
Well, isn't that interesting? I mean, the thing about Stratfor, which is interesting, is that they... he's just being honest there. He's saying it's not moral, it's cynical, but it worked. So we supported both sides in the Iran-Iraq war because we wanted them to kill each other so that we could control the Middle East, is effectively what he's saying. That's true. He's not wrong. But you can understand why that might cause a bit of resentment in the Middle East.
I mean,
actually,
what he's saying about spoiling attacks sounds like these loose scenarios we've been seeing,
yeah,
where they're going into countries like Afghanistan, Iraq, and say, oh dear, we lost, and then going home again and leaving the place in a terrible mess.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is what's going on. The oligarchy in the United States, allied with the oligarchy in Israel and the City of London, wants to dominate everything. The British Empire, at the height of its power, wanted to dominate the British Empire, one third of the world's earth surface, but they didn't aspire to dominate everything. The oligarchy now aspires to dominate everything. They cannot tolerate independent sources of power, such as democratic Venezuela, Iran, Russia, or China. And, you know, in actual fact, with a different mindset, it would be possible to reconcile everybody's interests on this tiny little bubble that we live on, floating in the middle of nowhere.
Well, he was talking
about... But, of course, this 19th century realpolitik think, which he's coming out with, is still dominant. It's now 2016, and people are still talking like Metternich as if it was 1850.
Well, he was talking
but
about...
But we've now got nuclear weapons.
He was talking about a cordon sanitaire around Russia, wasn't he? He's basically also saying he's going to put an end to the Russian Federation. They know that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, and that's why they're preparing to fight us.
Well,
but we're not. I mean, we're prepared. Our military are preparing to fight them, but our population haven't really been understood.
I mean,
to what extent
are the militaries of these countries like France and Britain and Germany, other countries in NATO, going to go along with the Americans when they do start?
Well,
fighting
there's
the
been
Russians?
Some interesting stuff in the Independent this week about various people in the SAS being very unhappy about the role they were asked to play in Iraq. And they quoted Ben Griffin, who's been on this programme, as ex-SAS soldier. But apparently SAS officers, which had cooperated in the Death Squad campaign, some SAS colonel said, well, the Americans were running death squads and we were being implicated in what they were doing. Ultimately, we are not the nice guys. I mean, what's interesting about Friedman there is he's just honestly coming out with what really motivates them. We're not the nice guys. We're not about democracy. We're not about freedom. We're about power. And we just want to win. And that's what we're about.
Top Russian public intellectual says we're on the verge of a global war. War is necessary, he says, for the preservation of the American system, and Russia is the main target. This is Sergei Glazyev. He's a Russian, an influential public intellectual whose views have wide traction among the Russian elites. A minister in 1993, a member of the State Duma up until 2007, and ran for president in 2004. He was co-founder of something called the Radina Party. He's basically saying, Martin, that that's it. I mean, there could be a global war any time. I also noticed that I would have used the audio, but obviously he's speaking in Russian. Vladimir Putin last week, the Russian president, is also saying that he doesn't know how to get through to people here, that what they're doing is potentially going to cause a nuclear war.
Well, Glazyev, I first came across Glazyev's name when I was in Moscow in 1993. I was talking with a woman whose name I won't divulge, who was partly because I can't remember it. that she was a former KGB officer who was now an executive in the World Bank in Moscow. So she was, you know, a highly educated person, and we sat up one night and discussed the situation in Russia. And I said to her, is there anybody in Russia who's got a clue? Because it seems to me that many of the people in charge are just starry-eyed about the West's intentions. They don't seem to understand what a mess is being created, etc. And she said, Glazyev. And so he was indicated to me as a very serious person in 1993. And I understand he is, in fact, one of Putin's closest advisors. He's actually a political economist. But he's also, a pretty deep thinker. Well, the Russians have got the message. They've been sent the message that we are going to break your legs. And they are preparing, they've got their own response to that. Thankfully, they're very calm. Their setup is a democratic setup insofar as anybody's is. And they are preparing to resist what they see as aggressive moves towards them.
People point the finger at Putin and say, look, he's just a king. But the fact of the matter is, he is very popular over there. And this week... he was meeting with foreign journalists at the conclusion of the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. It's a sort of Davos World Economic Forum version of that going on in St. Petersburg on the 17th of June, actually a month ago nearly, when he left no one in any doubt that the world is headed down a course which could lead to nuclear war. That's what he's saying, Martin. He railed against the journalists for their tall tales in blindly repeating lies and misinformation provided to them by the US on its anti-ballistic missile systems being constructed in Eastern Europe. He pointed out since the Iran nuclear deal, the claim the system is to protect against Iranian missiles has been exposed as a blatant lie. Journalists were informed that within a few years, Russia predicted the US would be able to extend the range of the system to 1,000 kilometres. At that point, Russia's nuclear potential, thus the nuclear balance between the US and Russia, would be in jeopardy. Putin completely lost patience with the journalists, berating them for lazily helping accelerate a nuclear confrontation by simply repeating US propaganda.
Well, you can see why he's saying what he's saying. I think the only straw of hope I can drag from all of this is that the thinking behind these anti-missile missiles is that you could knock out the Russian high command before they press the button to fire back, so that a first strike could knock them out. And that's why Kennedy went ballistic about the Russian missiles in Cuba.
What Putin actually said was, we know year by year what's going to happen, and they know that we know. It's only that you... that they tell tall tales to, and you buy it and spread it to the citizens of your countries. You people in turn do not feel a sense of impending danger. This is what worries me. How do you not understand that the world is being pulled in an irreversible direction here, while they pretend that nothing's going on? I don't know how to get through to you anymore. He's just addressing the Western mainstream press.
He is. I think that, as I say, there's one shred of comfort here, is that in actual fact this is all bluster. The Russians will have a second strike capacity, even if those missiles are in Eastern Europe. It creates the potential for accidents, absolutely. But of course, Russians have nuclear submarines, and if it comes down to it, they would be able to incinerate
our cities. And we do it all the time, to point our finger at the media. I mean, the London media, which interprets international and national news for us, they just... for example, with the September the 11th attacks, after you realise the lies that were told then, after September the 11th, in the immediate aftermath, and the complete failure of the London media to correct those lies about what really happened and who was behind it. Every time there's a major story, particularly to do with big international events, you've got to question it.
Well, of course. I mean, one of the main factors in modern hybrid warfare is control of information and what people think, which is why what we do here every week is so essential if we're going to get some kind of, if ordinary people are going to get some sense of what's going on. But I think we are, what the Americans, they don't want a war with the Russians. They want the Western Europeans to be weaned away from dealing constructively with the Russians, particularly the Germans, as Friedman pointed out in the Stratfor interview. So what they're looking to do is create an atmosphere of tension between Russia and the West, so that there's no economic relations between the Western countries and Russia, and therefore that we can be dominated by US multinationals through things like the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And of course, they treat war, as in between Iraq and Iran, or in Syria, or in Libya, or in Iraq and two invasions, as a means to these geopolitical ends. Of course, the people concerned, we're talking about ordinary people, they just get mashed to pieces. Is this an acceptable way to conduct international relations in 2016? I would say that it isn't.
I mean, probably the most important thing that we heard from George Friedman there was this absolutely cast-iron admission that the main job of the US and those that I suppose the Israelis as well, and the British that follow them, is to keep a wedge, drive a wedge between Germany and Russia, because those are the only two states that could threaten the US. And one of the things that Manfred Petrich from the All Smoke and Mirrors blog, who was on this show, a great long interview with him the other week, was saying it's exactly the same, is that he's moved out of Europe because he actually believes that this war is going to happen, and that because there's so many nuclear weapons and US troops stationed in Germany, that they're going to bear the brunt of it.
Well, do you know what I think? I don't think if nuclear weapons are used, then all bets are off. Even a minimal use of nuclear weapons is probably going to be fatal for our civilization. So we've just got to presume that everybody will be rational enough not to use nuclear weapons. But that means that we're going to fight with conventional weapons right up to the limit of those conventional weapons. So, for example, if Russia came under attack, it's quite likely that they would attack targets inside the United States with conventional weaponry and cause casualties. You know, if you're going to hurt us, we're going to hurt you. The Americans have the delusion that the only people who can hurt them are themselves, because they go around shooting each other like crazy, but they don't really have anybody else threatening them. But I think in modern terms, the Russian general staff will be thinking in terms of how can we hurt them if we have to, just as they're trying to hurt us.
The US cordon sanitaire that separates Germany and Russia, will the Ukrainians join it? I mean, that's effectively what he's saying, and I think they will, Martin.
Well, they already have, but of course the eastern Ukrainians have not, and the front line has developed there for that very reason. People don't realise how dangerous any of this is. We've also got, we've hardly talked about the economy, we've got an economic crisis of absolutely biblical proportions. And, you know, what's happened in the past,
well,
when we've had these
the
kind
guy
of crises.
Who's responsible for it has just walked away or been told to walk away. But look, we did mention at the top of the hour, didn't we, the Spratly Islands, because there was a big decision about that this week. And talking to the former US ambassador for Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, who was the head of maritime law at the Foreign Office, I thought he's the guy to have a chat to about this. And although he was busy with family stuff, he did say that actually what the Chinese are doing here is totally out of order. What they've done is they've created some artificial islands around these Spratly Islands, and they're building these big military bases on there. And the people in the Philippines, which effectively is a kind of little CIA outpost, a US outpost in the Philippines, are saying no. So although it's the US this time, what the Chinese are doing, I suppose, is just sticking two fingers up at the West and saying, well, if you're going to break the law, so can we.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically saying, you know, that would be their response. You're making it absolutely clear that might is right when you invade Iraq against Security Council resolutions or whatever. We're building some stuff on these islands. What are you going to do about it? And, of course, don't forget, if you are the Chinese, totally dependent on foreign trade, and they need to control the access routes to their coastline. I don't suppose the Americans are going to be very happy if Russian and Chinese warships turn off just outside the territorial waters in Los Angeles or New York. They would be very unhappy. And that's possibly where we're going to go.
The media plays a massive role in all this, of course, and it did in building up the case for the war in Iraq, didn't it? Although there was very little discussion about the way that the Director General Greg Dyke was sacked, or Andrew Gilligan, who flagged up the fact that the weapons of mass destruction was part of a dodgy dossier.
We've got an independent media in the sense that we're here being paid nothing at all to speak our minds, but then the real, you know, the media that most people use every day is either controlled by governments or by corporations. That's it. And as Noam Chomsky pointed out years ago, the purpose of media corporations is sales. They are determined by their advertisers, and their content is determined by the advertisers. That's what determines what can and can't be said. And it's partly to do with selling stuff, you know, specific things, you know, whether it's cigarettes or oil, and it's partly controlling the debate to make sure that alternative ways of looking at the world simply aren't thinkable, let alone discussable.
So it's kind of narrowing down the ability to discuss things. But I mean, people will talk about this stuff down the pub, don't they?
Well, they do. I mean, we're talking about it now on our show, and I hope our audience appreciates how serious-minded we are about it. But I tell you, an awful lot of the time, people are talking about trivialities because that's what, it's infotainment. The news on mainstream media is a series of propaganda stunts followed by human interest stories.
There are some very good
and sports.
And I think one of the good things about this is that there are some fantastic websites out there. One of them is Media Lens, that does a really good job, and follow them on Twitter if you don't already, because they are really pulling apart some of this. There are people like Owen Jones. They've pointed out, well, Owen Jones was very anti the European Union, but suddenly when it came to the referendum being announced, he completely changed his point of view. And what they've done is they put a whole load of quotes that he said before and a whole load of quotes that he said after. A lot of these mainstream journalists the same. And we're going to hear from Andrew Marr now, who's the BBC's political guru. I mean, he does Start the Week every week. He's on, does the Marr show at the weekends. And let's go back now to have a listen to what he had to say in 2003 about the Iraq War. This is about 2 minutes long. And it's a piece he did. I'm trying to get the exact date. Is it not going to be that easy, maybe? But he was... Oh, yeah, April the 9th, 2003, just as they were about to launch the Iraq War. He is now the BBC's so-called impartial Andrew Marr.
Well, for the view in Downing Street on today's events, let's talk to our political editor, Andrew Marr. Andy, is it safe to assume that Mr. Blair, like so many of the rest of us, was glued to his television for parts of today?
It certainly is. He and his advisers have been watching this, and, you know, all the usual caveats apply. There could be some ghastly scenes in the future. There could be terrorist attacks. All sorts of things could go wrong. But frankly, Hugh, the main mood is unbridled relief. I've been watching ministers wander around with smiles like split watermelons.
Well, Mr. Blair's had his share of troubles and worries, as you rightly say, over the past few weeks. We've talked about them many times.
Yes.
To what extent has that changed now today?
Well, I think this does one thing. It draws a line under what had been before this war, a period of when a faint air of pointlessness almost was hanging over Downing Street. There was all these slightly tawdry arguments and scandals. That is now history. Mr. Blair is well aware that all his critics out there in the party and beyond aren't going to thank him because they're only human for being right when they've been wrong. And he knows that there might be trouble ahead, as I've said. But I think this is a very, very important moment for him. It gives him a new freedom and a new self-confidence. He confronted many critics. I don't think anybody after this is going to be able to say of Tony Blair that he's somebody who is driven by the drift of public opinion or focus groups or opinion polls. He took all of those on. He said that they would be able to take Baghdad without a bloodbath and that in the end the Iraqis would be celebrating. And on both of those points he has been proved conclusively right, and it would be entirely ungracious, even for his critics, not to acknowledge that tonight he stands as a larger man and a stronger Prime Minister as a result.
Andrew, many thanks.
He stands as a larger man and a stronger Prime Minister as a result.
Well, it just goes to show how shallow people's understanding of these things is. It was never the contention of the anti-war forces that they wouldn't be able to storm into Iraq. Cakewalk to Baghdad. The problem is you cakewalk in, but you can't cakewalk out so easy. We're still in Afghanistan. We're still in Iraq. We're still in Syria. We're still in Libya. All total mess. Oh, and hey, some of these known nuts are starting to blow us up too as well. Do you remember all of the natural outrage about what's happened in Nice on Thursday? Don't forget, last week 250 people died in Baghdad in multiple car bombs. I don't see anybody wearing solidarity with Baghdad ribbons. But then they're only sand people, aren't they? We don't need to think about them as real people with credit cards. And
I mean, this is one of the major sides to the psychological warfare that we're living through these days. Is the fact that there is a terrorist attack, another terrorist attack, and we don't really get a chance to properly assess the previous one before the new one comes along. And that's definitely the case when it comes to this guy, James Howell, who was... he turned himself in, apparently, in the United States, saying that he was believed that he was being used by the intelligence services over there, and that he may be killed as a result. And it turns out that he was connected through also to the guy that tried to steal a gun and allegedly tried to shoot Donald Trump in the US. And a lot of these people seem to be connected.
And to Mateen. Sadiq Mateen, the Orlando
Omar
shooter.
Mateen.
What Howell's actually said is that he was trained in the same team as Mateen and this other English chap, and they were trained in a training camp in Florida by the CIA. And he said there were lots of people there, but my team included these three people. And that when he saw that after the Orlando shooting, that Mateen, his real name is Sadiq, and he was, if it's the same Sadiq, he was actually used as an informant by the FBI in a case previously, in order to convict somebody of terrorism. But he says we were all trained in this camp in how to blow things up and kill people, and I was just off to do a similar attack to the one in Orlando on a gay target. And then when I realised that Sadiq or Mateen had been assassinated during the operation, I realised that I was probably just going to be sacrificed. So he then handed himself into the police, and the police then briefed the media, but then the FBI then took him into their custody, although he had already been interviewed by an independent journalist woman, Brenda Corpian, who was then attacked and left for dead in a skip, but survived, as last I saw, had survived, and is under guard in a hospital in Florida. Now, none of this surprises you if you know the history of false flag terrorist attacks in general, and false flag terrorist attacks carried out by NATO intelligence services in particular. And there's a long list of them which independent police investigations in the past have pointed the finger very clearly at the intelligence services for these attacks.
Well, all I've got to say about all that is that thankfully Brenda Corpian is expected to fully recover, we hear, a couple of weeks ago. And I imagine that at which point she will not be on the London media talking about what she knows, because she has made some interesting connections.
We've moved on to Nice now. Orlando's yesterday. We don't need to know anything more about it.
Maybe, Martin, you can give us a couple of websites which are good ones to go to get some of this info, because, you know, whenever I see one of these attacks nowadays, I think, right, well, I'm just going to switch my ears off, not going to listen to what the mainstream media are telling me, I'm going to get online. It's the only place to get some semblance of the truth.
Patrick Henderson's 21st Century Wire, as you mentioned earlier, is pretty solid, as is globalresearch.ca, a Canadian website. I would those are what I would regard as the credible websites, which genuinely investigate these issues.
There's other ones like Information Clearinghouse. Maybe we'll put a little list up on the website tonight, because this seems to be accelerating, doesn't it?
Well, what people need to do when they have an incident like this happens, if they've got the time and the inclination, is to look at several different sources and to try and find out what's actually happened.
Now,
but you've also got to work with the working assumption that the intelligence services are usually behind spectacular terrorist attacks.
Now,
not always, but usually.
I mean, we could call them a criminal elite running things at the moment, and that's how I do that frequently as I can do, because that's what they seem to be, in the criminality filtering down through society from the top. No real justice either in many ways, in many cases. But one of the things that shocked me was Henry Kissinger and his ability to get away with sending U.S. Nuclear weapons equipment over to the Soviet Union in the 1970s. So let's have a listen to the author Anthony Sutton now talking about Kissinger's role in actually trying to make sure that there was an arms race.
Now, in 1948, there was a fascinating book came out by Major Racy Jordan, in which he talked about American aid to the communists as far as their ability to build nuclear weapons. Did you ever have an opportunity of verifying the facts that we had given them the heavy water, we'd given them the wherewithal to build their atomic weapons?
Well, as part of the work I was doing at Stanford, I did investigate the shipping documents for Lend-Lease, and I took a sample of these documents, and I checked them against Major Jordan. And broadly, Major Jordan was correct within, say, about 5%. And Major Jordan, of course, made the charge that we had shipped materials to the Soviets, 1944, 1945, which were later used in their atomic program. There is no doubt he is correct. We shipped heavy water, which is essential, but we shipped other items which are perhaps less obvious to the layman. We shipped, for example, aluminum tubes, and aluminum tubes are essential for atomic energy development. We shipped graphite, and graphite is another essential component. So generally, as far as I could check, and I checked the original government Lend-Lease document, General Major Jordan was correct.
Now, as the years have gone by, of course, we see a growing Soviet nuclear threat. The Soviets now have MIRV missiles. Mm-hmm. Can you get a little of the background on how the Soviet Union, which really didn't have the technology to develop those MIRV missiles that threaten our cities today, how were they able to develop the MIRV capacity?
Well, you've got to go back and look at how the Russians were able to develop a rocket, space technology anyway. What they did after World War II was American forces were held back for a while the Soviets occupied East Germany. They stripped East Germany. They took back the latest of the V-2 rocket technology from Peenemünde and other places. And the V-2 became the basis of the Russian space technology. Now, if you skip the intervening years, you will find when you come to the early 1970s that the Russians did not have the capability to MIRV their missiles. And in particular, they lacked the ability to produce the very precision, micro-miniature ball bearings that are needed for the control systems. There was only one company in the world, Bryant, Chuck and Grinder, which could make the machinery which machines the races which within which these ball bearings run. And without those races, you just cannot make MIRV missiles in any quantity. You can make one off, but not in quantity. Bryant, Chuck and Grinder was allowed to ship to the Soviet Union 45 of these machines at a time when we only had 33 in the United States.
But wasn't there any objection to doing this?
I objected at Miami Beach in 1972. Other people objected, but the objections were squashed. And predominantly at fault here is Henry Kissinger and the incoming Nixon administration. This was known. I'm sure it was known in DOD. If I knew it, then certainly DOD knew it. But the objections were squashed, and there was suppression of the information.
And so once again, we see America building up the military capacity, the nuclear threat from the Soviet Union?
Well, this goes, you know, when you talk about moving of missiles, you're talking about a quantum jump in your military technology. Now, I'm not a military man, but to me, the ability to do that is a massive leap forward. And we enabled them to do it, and we did it knowingly and deliberately.
Now, the MIRVing of missiles, for those who don't know, is the multiple independent re-entry vehicles. So that means that you can send up one intercontinental ballistic missiles, but maybe eight or something warheads will then come raining down on these nukes, Martin.
Well, I it's interesting to hear this. I think I'd like more independent confirmation of what was going on. We know, for example, that the Rosenbergs were executed in the 1940s because they basically passed nuclear secrets from the US to the Russians. Jonathan Pollard, the Israeli spy in the US Navy, he was convicted of passing nuclear secrets to the Israelis, which were then passed to the Russians in return for concessions on Jews leaving the former Soviet Union. But, I mean, the implication of this, if it's true, is that the military-industrial complex in the West made sure that the Soviet military-industrial complex was sufficiently threatening so that they could carry on producing useless weaponry in the West. In other words, the arms race was in the interests of the corporations in the West. Therefore, it was necessary for the Soviets to be sufficiently threatening so that they would be able to say, we need more money to develop our own technology to defeat them. And I think that's pretty much the logic of what goes on. A lot of what goes on is literally an arms race for the sake of an arms race, because armed races are profitable for those who sell weapons. And that's the sort of thing that people used to believe about the military-industrial complex after the First World War. It's not entirely inconceivable that we still live in the same universe.
I mean, what George Friedman was saying earlier from Stratfor was effectively that the US has been kind of managing this conflict in Europe. You know, what do you think, where is that developing? Because it's going into the Middle East now. We've had these two world wars in Europe, and he was, you know, referring effectively to this as a kind of continuum between World War One, World War Two, and possibly World War Three.
Well, World War Three has been raging for quite a while. People
well, so actually, you mentioned Vincenzo Vinciguerra earlier. He actually says that in the Gladio documentary.
Yeah.
Alan Frankovich's film, doesn't he? He says, actually, in 1945, World War Two finished and World War Three began.
Indeed, and that's what we've been living in with that ever since. I mean, the dangers in the current circumstances are extremely powerful. We're going through the anniversary of the First World War at the moment, 1916, the Battle of the Somme and all the rest of it, Easter Rising and so on. We are living in equally dangerous times where miscalculation is more likely to lead to war than anything else. I mean, we had a potential dogfight between US and Russian planes over Syria recently. That wasn't number one on the mainstream media, was it? Because nobody got killed and no planes were shot down. They backed down. But well, they could have been, and that could have escalated almost immediately into a full-scale confrontation between Russia and NATO.
Our local MP, Jack Lepresti, actually brought up the Syria conflict in David Cameron's final Prime Minister's questions this week.
Yeah. Jack Lepresti!
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And I'd like to also pay tribute to my admirable friend and all the hard work he's done leading this great country for the last few years.
Yeah.
Now, our honourable friend's lasting legacy will include supporting the Kurds, whose Peshmerga are bravely fighting Daesh, in all our interests. Now, having visited the Peshmerga on the front line, I know that our airstrikes, weapons and training are crucial, but Peshmerga injuries could be reduced with additional equipment like body armour, respirators and frontline medical facilities. And we could possibly provide some beds in our specialist hospital in Birmingham to the most seriously injured. Does my rotten friend agree that this is a relatively small investment that would make a huge difference to our allies in our common fight to defeat the evil of terrorism?
Yeah. Well, let me say to my honourable friend, first of all, thank you for his kind remarks. But also, he's absolutely right that the Kurds are incredibly brave fighters and are doing valuable work against Daesh in Iraq and Syria. I'll look carefully at his suggestion of using the Birmingham Hospital. The Queen Elizabeth Hospital has excellent facilities for battlefield casualties. Our army is already providing medical instruction to the Peshmerga to help them deal with these situations, but we will look and see if more can be done. But let's be frank, the strategy is working. Daesh is on the back foot. It's lost 45% of of the territory it once held in Iraq. Its finances have been hit. More than 25,000 Daesh fighters have now been killed. Desertion has increased, and the flow of foreign fighters has fallen by 90%. I've always said this will take a long time to work in Iraq and Syria, but we must stick at it, and we must stay the course.
Well, it's just a load of flim-flam, really. I mean, insofar as Daesh has been hit, it's been hit by the Syrian army and the Russians. And, of course, he's talking about the Peshmerga in Iraq there. I say victory to the Kurdish fighters in Turkey, who are fighting NATO, even though they are brutal, and they kill. And the Turkish army has killed hundreds of civilians in the Kurdish areas of Turkey. Victory to the PKK. Down with the NATO, and let's. Who are the pacifists? I'm not one of them.
Who are the Peshmerga?
The Peshmerga is referring to the military wings of the KDP and the K and the K. I can't remember the other name in Iraq, and they are separatists. And quite repressive, and of course I'm not against their aspirations for an independent Kurdistan, but I'm not against the aspirations for an independent Kurdistan in Turkey. And we all know that Turkey are the main suppliers of ISIS, with the funding mainly coming from Saudi Arabia. And we could easily prevent them from getting support if we were to go to war with Turkey, our NATO ally.
Now, one of the articles you pointed out to me a couple of weeks ago, Martin, was that you're talking about the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, and a handful of families have actually owned a large amounts of the Western world for a long, long period of time. Is it really possible that that could actually just be a handful of families that have been running things?
Well, we'll have to put a link up to the article and people make up their own minds. Let's just put it this way. The powerful tend to remain powerful, and they tend to want their sons and daughters to be as powerful as they are. And that's been a constant in history since the Roman Empire and before. Nothing much has changed.
You know what? I think we should have a good look at that next week. Anyway, that's all for this week. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Up now, there's a gap in the schedule. Mohamed Makawi's out in the Sudan for a few weeks. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim and Henley's Jeff Gollop. We're online at thisweek.org.uk, where you'll find links of all sorts, and I'm Tony Gosling on Twitter and off Twitter. Do please join us for the politics show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.